This one is an interesting one. This talks about the relationship that people have within their own homes. So if any of you have any kind of a tense relationship between yourself and either your mother or your mother-in-law or somebody like that, you will very much identify with the subject for today. You're muttering already. Okay, somebody could start off and read paragraph zero. That introduces the lesson.
I hear Wormwood. I am very pleased by what you tell me about this man's relations with his mother. But you must press your advance. The enemy will be working from the center outwards, gradually bringing more and more of the patient's conduct under the new standard. You may reach his behavior to the old lady at any moment. You want to get in first. Keep in close touch with our colleague, Evo, who is in charge of the mother, and build up between you and that house a good, settled habit of mutual annoyance. Daily pinprick. The following methods are useful.
Yeah, we'll get into the methods that he's going to use in a little bit, but you can probably already see where he's going with this. We'll start, though, with the sentence, the enemy, talking about God, will be working from the center outwards, gradually bringing more and more of the patient's conduct under the new standard. What do you think he's referring to at that point? Okay, it says from the center outwards, so you say starting with the heart, and then it says gradually bringing more and more of the patient's conduct under the new standard.
Transforming the man's
spirit. Gradually transforming the life. They say it starts with a conversion of the heart, but eventually that's supposed to translate into what people do, their daily activities and their actions, and eventually into how they treat other people. And so what he says is it may reach his behavior to the old lady at any moment. You want to get in first. So he says you need to intercept that. You need to stop his actions before they start affecting how he treats his mother. Apparently, they don't have a particularly good relationship, and he wants to keep it that way. So that's something that we can use to our advantage as demons. So he talks about mutual annoyance and daily pinpricks. Has anybody ever experienced daily pinpricks with anybody that you live with? You know, it may have been siblings growing up, or it may be parent-child, it may be husband and wife, so we don't want to get too much into that today. I think after the sweetheart dinner, Russ's calendar is already full with family counseling. But yeah, has anybody experienced that that you'd like to share with the class?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have a teenager at home?
No,
that's like a daily thing. A teenager, especially a male,
and
a mother.
Oh, yes. A son who just loves to touch people's nerves, you know, and knows exactly how to do that. Okay, I'd like to direct your attention to 2 Corinthians 3:18. It talks about this process that Screwtape is referring to. Anybody that gets there can go ahead and read it. 2 Corinthians 3:18.
But we all with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image, from glory to glory, just as by the Spirit of the Lord.
Okay. So he's talking about what Screwtape is talking about here. That we reflect the Lord's glory and we're transformed into his likeness. So it's not an instant process when we become a Christian. We're not just automatically better people. It's something that has to happen over a period of time. It's something that we learn to do. So what Screwtape says is you need to interfere with that process. You're talking to Wormwood. He says you need to stop that change of behavior before it starts. That kind of feeds on itself. have some handouts, ladies, if you want.
Okay.
Okay, so he says the following methods are useful. If somebody could read paragraph one.
Keep his mind on the inner life. He thinks his conversion is something inside him, and his attention is therefore chiefly turned at present to the state of his own mind, or rather to that very exuberant version of them which is all you should allow him to see. Encourage this. Keep his mind off the most elementary duties by directing it to the most advanced and spiritual ones. Aggravate his most human characteristic, the horror and neglect of the obvious. You must bring him to a condition in which he can practice self-examination for an hour without discovering any of those facts about himself, which are perfectly clear to anyone who has overlived in the same house with him or worked at the same office.
Okay. All right. This is kind of written in a complicated way. Expurgated, kind of think of it as edited version. Our view of ourself is not generally the same as other people's view of us. Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes we wouldn't really want to know all the details of what other people thought about us. But we definitely have an edited version of ourselves where we can kind of filter out the bad things and only see the good things about ourselves. So that's what Screwtape says that he can use to his advantage. He says, bring him to a condition in which he can practice self-examination for an hour without discovering any of those facts about himself that are perfectly clear to anybody else that's had to live or work with.
I was just going to mention, sometimes you have such a bad self-image that it can keep you from God, too. You know, thinking, the things I've done are just too bad for God to take care of. Or sometimes we think we're just a little bit better than what the world makes us be. So either which way, it can keep you from God.
That's true. Some people have very low self-esteem, and people think much better of them than they think of themselves.
And so a demon could take this and run with it, either which way.
Either way.
Yeah.
Could be useful to them. Okay? Says Screwtape implies that true conversion is not merely an internal process. And there are some scripture references here. But before we get to those, what do you think about conversion? About it being internal process versus external process?
There has to be external change that shows the internal process is actually working. That's a basic fundamental. You talk about, I talk so much about the core of the gospel that Jesus told the woman caught in adultery, now go and leave your life of sin.
There are two schools of thoughts in psychiatry and psychology a lot of times. One is that what's on the inside drives what you do on the outside. The other is that the things that you do externally influence you internally. And so, for example, some people would take the attitude that, you know, your internal core values that you have are what drive your external actions. But other people would argue that you can change how you feel by changing what you do. And as an example, whenever your kids are little, sometimes you look for service projects to go and have them do. And they don't want to, as kids. You know, that's not something that they've learned to think beyond themselves. Children are, by their very nature, very selfish. You know, I want to do what I want to do. But the theory is if you take them out and let them experience what it's like to help out in a soup kitchen, to help out with inner city children, if you have them help out in after a disaster with doing cleanup, that will modify them internally, that they'll start seeing the effect that it has on other people, and that they'll start to realize that they should think unselfishly instead of selfishly. So what are the thoughts of the class on that? Yes?
Well, I'm going to take myself for example here. When I first became a Christian, a lot of the things that I changed about my behavior and outward things was because I knew I had to change that. But the more I got to know God, the more all of these became a labor of love. Then it came from the inside. You know what I'm saying? But it began with doing things on the outside because I knew it was required of me, or I knew I need to do this. But it didn't have very much to do with my heart yet, not until I got to know God more.
Okay. All right. Anybody else there?
Yeah, I think we, you know, as a psychologist, I think that the real change takes place first in the mind. The mind is oftentimes moved, you know, by the actions that take place. The Apostle Paul tells us in Romans 12:1-2, do not conform any longer to the patterns of this world. That's behavior. Mm-hmm. How do we keep from doing that? He says, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You change the way you behave by changing the way you think. But sometimes we're motivated to change our thinking by the behaviors that initialize things. There's a saying that we use sometimes is act better than you feel. You know, that sometimes I don't feel like doing a particular thing, but I make myself do it anyway, and when I'm mm-hmm. finished, I feel better about doing it. And then hopefully I've learned something from that starts to change my mind. That behavior that I'm doing is only temporary. If we want lasting change, then it's got to come from the mind. We change the way we think. We can do temporary stuff, you know, all the time. But if it's going to be a lasting thing that's going to go on, then it's got to go to the mind and change our thinking, and then our behavior will, on a regular basis, change.
I think that's exactly right. Part of it is being able to separate thinking and feeling. I think sometimes I feel like lying in bed, but I consciously think, no, I should go up to the building and help with the service project that's going on today. And so I make myself do that, and then, as you say, it changes my heart. If you separate mind and heart, even though we know they're both part of the brain, in some ways it feels like they're two separate things.
Well, we also have to allow for, you know, for God to change us. One of the more subtle changes in thinking along these lines is that we, you know, we can have the internal, you know, the mind motivation, and it's a mistake that the new Christians make frequently. They say, okay, I have to change, and I'm convicted of my own sin. And then they proceed to try to fix everything on their own.
Right.
Okay, and, you know, and that's one of Satan's more subtle tools, because he knows you can never do that. So, you know, applied properly, you know, these two things, the inner conversion and the outer actions, complement each other. Misapplied, they're destructive.
What is Screwtape trying to do? What is his suggestion here?
He's looking for the misapplication.
Okay, he's trying to interfere with that process.
Yeah.
He knows that those are a mutual thing. You know, I mentioned the two schools of thought about the heart driving the actions or the actions driving the heart. The reality is, of course, they feed on themselves. It's a continuous cycle. The choice isn't one or the other. The choice is that both of them have an effect, and it can work either way. Your actions can drive your thoughts and your heart, or your heart and your thoughts can drive your actions. And the ideal situation is that you want this continuous motion in the right direction of your thoughts and minds. What Screwtape is suggesting is interfere with that process. Keep it internal and don't let it become external. Don't let thoughts drive actions. In other words, keep treating the cantankerous mother the same way you always have. Don't treat her any better than you ever did before. This is what Wormwood is supposed to be whispering in his patient's ear. You know, keep treating her the same. Because Wormwood knows, and Screwtape knows, that if you allow him to start treating her differently, he's going to think about her differently. And so he says, I want to stop that process right now. So keep him thinking about internal spiritual things rather than those physical things on the outside. Okay? He mentions in here 2 Corinthians 5:15. There's a quote here in the questions here that says, loving my neighbor is great for relationships, but business is business. So some people would separate out certain things from their Christian life. Say, well, you know, my Christian life is good for while I'm at church or maybe at home with my family, but in my business dealings, sometimes I have to do things that are different, so I'm going to compartmentalize that and keep that separate.
Starts treating his mother differently, and she sees that, and it'll have an effect on her. So, you know, things will start hopefully turning in the positive, and, you know, then that relationship hopefully would eventually get better, but you know, they don't want that to happen. So, you know, by our actions, it's going to influence, hopefully, you know, the environment.
Yes.
Is that not something you're not supposed to do? If you're a Christian, are you not supposed to take that with you everywhere you go, not just
exactly.
in church?
Oh, yes. Yes. that was actually the point I was making. I said some people try to compartmentalize the religion, and they'll keep it to this is how I act on Sunday, this is how I act the rest of the week, when the reality is it should affect everything that we do. But what Wormwood's trying to do is allow the patient to rationalize that. Of, you know, as long as I'm thinking good thoughts about other people, I don't actually have to put that into practice. You know, it's like, you know, I love you as a person, but, you know, if you actually need some help, you know, well, that's a lot of work.
My friend, she has that problem at work with the boss. The boss goes to her, she's a Christian, but when she's at work, this is work, this is not the other, and that's where they're having the conflict. And, well, actually, I feel sorry for the woman because she's having a conflict with her Christian beliefs and her worldly actions. She's separating them so much that you can't tell that she's supposed to be a Christian at work. It's
well, there's a lot of people that live two lives. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our religious life and our secular life, and we don't mix the two. You know, and that's my, you know, I go to church on Sunday and live like the devil the rest of the week. You know, again, as you said, it's, you know, we're supposed to live as a Christian. That's supposed to be who we are all the time, not just where we are at any given time in our life. It's not like a coat that we put on and take off, depending on where we are.
So that's the process we go through. We first read the Word, and we understand intellectually what it's saying. Then that should translate into what we do, how we act, and the things that we do. And gradually our heart changes as a result, because right at first we do what we know we're supposed to do. And then after a period of time, we realize the full implications of that we're doing this out of love, and we start to understand, and then that becomes our motivation. At a certain point, then we want to act a certain way. It's not just we're doing it because we know intellectually that's what we're supposed to do. Our heart changes, and we begin to think differently about other people because of that we feel differently about other people. And for some people, they can separate thinking and feeling in such a way where they compartmentalize the two, where those don't interact, and they have to interact as a Christian. One has to influence the other. Okay, let's get into the specifics of prayer here in paragraph 2. I'll have somebody read that.
It is, no doubt, impossible to prevent him from praying for his mother, but we have means of rendering the prayers innocuous. Make sure that they are always very spiritual, and that he is always concerned with the state of her soul, and never with her rheumatism. Two advantages follow. In the first place, his attention will be kept on what he regards as her sins, by which, with a little guidance from you, he can be induced to mean any of her actions which are inconvenient or irritating to himself. Thus, you can keep rubbing the wounds of the day a little sore, even while he is on his knees. The operation is not at all difficult, and you will find it very entertaining. In the second place, since his ideas about her soul will be very crude and often erroneous, he will, in some degree, be praying for an imaginary person, and it will be your task to make that imaginary person daily less and less like the real mother, the sharp-tongued old lady at the breakfast table. In time, you may get the cleavage so wide that no thought or feeling from his prayers for the imagined mother will ever flow over into his treatment of the real one. I have had patients of my own so well in hand that they could be turned at a moment's notice from the impassioned prayer for a wife's or son's soul into beating or insulting a real wife or son without a qualm.
Sounds a little scary, doesn't it? If they could have this kind of influence on us. What do you think about this? I'm sorry, Rick, go ahead. Like about 45 questions all wrapped up in it. But it appears that what you're trying to get to is that obviously these demons can't make you think a certain thing. They can't control your thoughts, but they can bring certain things to mind. And it seems like that's what they're discussing here at this point, that you can't make your patient hate his mother, but you can, while he's praying for her soul, remember her irritating voice and the annoying way that she has of talking to him. You can bring that to his memory so that so that he keeps these negative attitudes toward his mom all the time.
But I guess my concern is, how can they focus that book? The opposite of that, or the flip side of that, is you know, when we sometimes sit down and when we read our Bible, a chapter into it or several verses into it, all of a sudden it really enhances your spiritual being. But on the flip side of that, how are these demons, how are they able to do their work in the dark? We know how the word works. Mm-hmm. How do they work?
Spiritual warfare.
All right.
Human nature. They know what the human nature is.
Yeah. From letter number one, you go back to all of a sudden while you're reading and you're starting to get into it, wow, I'm sleepy. Wow, I'm hungry. You know, why is the dog barking? You know, distraction. It seems like one of the main weapons.
Are they thought provokers?
Not
so much that. Remember the last two or three. ordinances of the first letter, you know, where Screwtape says, you know, the way some of you fiends act, you younger ones, you'd think that our purpose was to teach. You know, that's not what we're about, okay? That's not what Wormwood, Screwtape, and Bluebose, and, you know, the whole cast of characters, all they really need to do is interfere with your learning of the truth, okay? They don't have to teach you anything. They don't have to convince you to hate each other. All they got to do is just keep you where you are and get you to where you don't love them. You know, they don't really have to, you know, give you a good argument for not disbelieving. They just have to deal with the process of believing and faith development.
Especially when you've got two people that spend a lot of time together. You know, in this case, the patient and his mother, or husband and wife, or parents and children. It really doesn't take a whole lot for things to begin to irritate you. You know, it can be as something simple as, oh, wow, they took the toothpaste and put it way over there out of my reach on the other side. The sink, you know, how thoughtless of them. I'm sure they did that just to irritate me. You know, you can start with something that's completely innocent. And in your own mind, you can build up this whole scenario into this person hates me.
Or I hate them.
Or and as a result, I hate them.
Have you ever worked in a cubicle setting?
Yes.
There's a woman that it took me a long time to get to like. She works right next to the cubicle. She cannot work without music going, but she won't wear headphones. So I had to learn to tune it out. And I tell you what, if you want to make an enemy of me, whistle. She'll just be sitting there and just all of a sudden start whistling and just whistle a couple of notes. And I just want to come over the cube and rip her head out. I cannot stand whistling. I was a guy whistling in the store the other day.
I guess you should have said that.
I will.
But she's in a good mood. That's somebody, I whistle because I'm happy. I do it all the
time. Yes, but I'm sitting there and all of a sudden I hear that sharp sound and I'm trying to read and it just...
So get you some music and talk.
I like her now. But the point is, to see here's what you're saying. I need to get used to it. You see, it's the same thing that's happened here in the story. You need to just get used to what I do, because I'm going to do it.
But it's pleasant. It's
no,
not
it's not.
That's
not to me.
But it's not. She's not being
she's
mean.
She's not being mean, and I like her now. We're okay.
She's been happy in herself.
So I know. I got that.
You should always take from being happy yourself and not because of
but
others.
But see, sometimes you do things that you think just make you really happy, and they grate on the other person's nerves. Nell may watch a TV show that I don't like, so I go on the other end and watch that. You may think, why don't you like this show? This is awesome. But see, we all do things that we don't think that bother anybody, and they shouldn't bother anybody, but they do. Well, we can like each other now. I've tuned it out. You know what I'm saying? I don't like whistling, but I've tuned it out. Exactly, as a process.
But that's Screwtape's.
Exactly.
You know, that's his way of saying, okay, let me create friction between
exactly.
these people.
Yeah, we have to remember that the natural state
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's their job is much easier because what they have to do is try to keep us there.
Mm-hmm.
See, but we have to always remember the whole aspect of spiritual warfare, that on the one side we've got God and His angels that are working through His Spirit to guide us and to teach us and to help us to adhere to the new standard of living. That God wants us to go by, to go away from our natural self, whereas, you know, the demons, Screwtape and, you know, and the others, are trying to keep us where we were. That's really what the battle is all about. Paul says in Galatians chapter 5, he reminds us of this conflict that's going on. He says, so I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature. That's what we live in, is a sinful nature. He says, for the sinful nature desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the sinful nature. They are in conflict with each other so that you do not do what you want. So therein is what the battle is all about. It is the one trying to teach us what we need to learn to live a different life, and the other trying to keep us. You know, as Steve said, it's not a matter of teaching us, it's just a matter of keeping us from learning the new way, and therein is the battle.
It's just like Gary talking about sitting around people that sang out of tune in church, you know. Okay, well, you either learn to deal with it, or maybe you sit in a different spot next time, or something. But you gotta learn to deal with it. And the thing is, we have to remember too that we are constantly doing things too that may be a stumbling block to someone. And so, you know, and sometimes you have to make some compromise.
We may be not whistling. Maybe that irritates the other people. They want us to whistle.
So maybe, yeah.
I mean, let's just say, to me, whistling to me, because I do it too. So I'm happy about it. That's when I'm like cleaning house or at home. I'm like,
yeah, but you're not sitting in a cube next to somebody trying to read and concentrate and stuff like that. So,
the perfect screw tape movie. Have you ever seen the movie Needful Things? Mm-hmm. It's the devil, but he approaches individual people. It's like a thrift store. And he has various objects that appeal to you. Mm-hmm. So he makes those objects accessible to you, but ultimately what he's doing is he gives them to you, thinking that it's something that he's doing nice. But in return, he's causing conflict. Mm-hmm. So if you ever get a chance, the name of the movie is called Needful Things.
That explains the name of that store in Hopewell. I thought, where did they come up with that?
Yeah, but it's got some bad words in it.
Yeah, reminds me of Bedazzled, where the guy ever got everything that he wanted from the devil and it never worked out. Ever.
Right. He always got exactly what he asked for, but it never worked out the way that he wanted it.
Yeah, he asked for a Big Mac, and so you see him later, they're riding on a city bus over to the McDonald's, and he thought she was just going to hand him the Big Mac. No.
Yeah, then he had to pay for it, and he said, okay, that was your first wish. Okay. Yeah.
Would it surprise anybody to know that letter 3 here is just where people either stop and say, I don't like this book very much, and quit reading, or they continue on with it.
All of a sudden, it starts sounding a little too familiar.
This is where he makes it really personal. The first 2 letters, you know, are a little ephemeral, you know, between mm-hmm. the second one. When you get to the third one, you blink and go, oh, dear.
Yes, all of a sudden, it sounds a little bit too much like our own lives.
It's a little too close to home.
Okay, somebody read paragraph 3. It's a little more specific about what's going on.
When two humans have lived together for many years, it usually happens that each has tunes of voice and expressions of faith which are almost unendurably irritating to the other. Work on that. Bring fully into the consciousness of your patient that particular lift of his mother's eyebrows, which he learned to dislike in the nursery. And let him think how much he dislikes it. Let him assume that she knows how annoying it is and does it to annoy. If you know your job, he will not notice the immense improbability of the assumption. And of course, never let him suspect that he has tuned and looked with similarly annoyed him, as he cannot see or hear himself. This is easily managed. In civilized life, domestic hatred usually expresses itself by saying things which would appear quite harmless on paper. The words are not offensive. But in such a voice or at such a moment that they are not far short of a blow in the face. To keep this game up, you and Blue Bowl, I hope I've been answering must see to it that each of these 2 foods have some. To keep this game up, you and Rumbo must see to it that each of these 2 foods as a sort of double standard. Your patient must demand that all his own utterances are to be taken at their face value and judged simply on the actual words. While all of the same the time judging all his mother's utterances with the fullest and most oversensitive interpretation of the tone and the context and the suspected intent. She must be encouraged to do the same to him. Hence, from every qual that they can both go away convinced, or very nearly convinced, that they are quite innocent. You know the kind of thing. I simply asked her what time dinner would be, and she flies into a temper. Once this habit is well established, you have the delightful situation of a human saying things with the express purpose of offending and yet having a grievous when offense is taken.
We can pause there before we go on. All of you have probably seen TV shows where somebody will say something and the other person will take offense. And they're like, all I said was this. You know how, especially if you had teenagers in the house, you know how they can talk to each other, and then whenever they repeat it back to you in a completely different tone of voice, it sounds perfectly innocent what they said. All I said was this. You know, but that's not the way it came across. There's so much that can be carried with tone of voice. Yes, Pat.
I found that with me, and I didn't realize I was doing it, but I was working so hard on not arguing with my husband that I would not say anything, but I would go. He got on me about it. It irritated him, and then I kept doing it. I mean, it was like habit. Every time he would irritate me or say something, I'd go like, it took me a while to really work hard and stop doing that, because I would get to the point that I think I was doing it deliberately to irritate me back. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what he's talking about here. You're right. It doesn't have to be verbal. It can be nonverbal. If you've ever talked to a teenager and had them roll their eyes, you know, they don't have to say a thing. You know, I didn't say a thing, Mom. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that was the point. I wasn't saying anything. And then it took me to really dawn on what I really was truly doing. And then I had to work really hard to stop taking my hits.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you don't have to say anything for the person to know what you're thinking a lot of times.
Dale, experts in human communication tell us that our verbal communications are made up of really two parts. There's the content and the process. The content is the actual words that we say, which really only make up 7% of the communication. The process is divided into tone of voice and body language, makes up 93%. And so whenever there's a conflict between those two, process is always going to be believed. Mm-hmm. We have to remember that, and that's why we oftentimes get into those things where we, you know, well, you said this, I didn't say that. Yes, you did. Well, you may not have said those words, but your tone of voice and body language, right, that's the message the person received. Mm-hmm. And that's an effective tool that I think Satan uses on us a lot when we don't realize what's going on in communication that way. Mm-hmm. We often say a lot more with our tone of voice and our body language than we ever say with the actual words that we use.
That's part of the difficulty that people have in communicating by emails or by texting, is you can read the words, and how you read them is has a lot to do with how you interpret how they were intended. Because without having those nonverbal cues of how to take something, it's hard to tell sometimes. You may read an email that somebody sent you as a slap in the face when they didn't mean it that way at all, in the way that they sent it.
Well, especially for communication, not for what you say, spelling, but you want to start hear an argument at my house, whenever Ann starts getting on Charlie's nerves, all he does is mispronounce a few key words. She was an honors English person. She cannot stand whenever he mispronounces a few key words. If he pronounces the T in often, she flies. She's like, Mom. If he says, all he has to say the word mischievous. That's not how it's pronounced. And they start screaming at each other.
Oh, yeah.
That's all it takes.
Yeah. And when you live with somebody, after a while, you know what pushes their buttons. And so you can say something that to the casual observer would be completely innocent, but you and the person on the receiving end both know. Yeah, they both know what was intended by that.
And this too can spill over into relationships with anybody. Christina used to have the bad habit when we get into a small argument, go, whatever. Now if I just hear that word from anybody, it's just, you know, but it can spill over outside your family because of something that has gotten you to the point. It's so irritating that it doesn't matter who says it, that your barometer starts going up just because of that one word, you know. And it's something that I really have to work on, you know. Just because she irritated me with that doesn't mean that these other people mean the same thing, but it's just that one word. It gets me.
If the family members know what buttons to push, you know that Satan knows what buttons to push.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the whole point of this.
But isn't that the purpose of this here? To recognize what you are doing to irritate someone.
Yes, because you can't affect what somebody else does,
right.
But you can control what you do. And so that's the idea, is for you to read this introspectively and say, hey, I think actually I resemble this remark. And so.
I think a lot of people pass too, because sometimes they're a lot of life. Like, I know that's why that classic thing, because we are a lot of life. Things that we know we can bump heads on and we don't want to give.
You got two stubborn people. Okay, we're running out of time. If somebody can read the last short paragraph there.
Finally, tell me something about the old lady's religious position. Is she all that jealous of the new thing and her son's life? That all teach that she should have learned from others? So late that she considers she gave them such a good opportunity of learning in childhood, that she feels he is making a great deal of fuss about it, or that he's getting in on it, and that he's getting in on very easy terms. Remember the elder brother in the enemy story. Your affectionate uncle.
Okay. Who's the elder brother in the enemy story?
Prodigal son.
Yep. Whenever I did this in the scene class, you know, I immediately thought of the prodigal son and the older brother. Somebody in there, I think it was Stuart, said, I thought of Cain and Abel. But I didn't think about Cain and Abel.
We started talking about a bunch of different brothers.
Yeah, and actually the more we started talking, Jacob and Esau. And we started realizing, hey, actually there's a lot of older brothers in this Bible stories that fit this. Comment here. Okay, well, we'd like to have covered a little bit more about that, but we're out of time.
Thank you.
Thanks for your attention this morning.